You're listening to Builderpedia, your go-to podcast for everything you need to know about property. By covering the entire journey from buying your home through to design, building, selling, and everything in between, we'll help you fill in the blanks and bring your property vision to life.
Ian Moore, welcome to Builderpedia.
Thank you, Matt. Thanks for the invitation.
Look, I've really been looking forward to this. It's been a while since we've chatted. You're an exceptional architect and you've got a special place in my experience of architecture. I cut my teeth on one of your projects as a graduate project manager, and it was my first experience of a true architectural home. I presume you remember Balmoral House?
Yes, I do indeed.
For me, it was a revelation. It was a different world of construction and architecture, and I've never gone back. That was the lifting of the curtain.
Well, that's good. That's good. My background in New Zealand was growing up, my father was a builder. So I grew up on a building site. So I literally been on a building site since the day I was born. And he was building when I was doing technical drawing at high school when I was about 13 or 14. That was his way of saving a bit of money so he didn't have to pay the draftsman down the road to do them. But I watched him building some interesting houses, a couple that were designed by architects. He didn't much like architects, and he didn't want me to become an architect. He went out of his way to stress that he wanted me to do something sensible, like engineering.
So that's why you did engineering? What was his influence?
Yeah, I did, but it was never my intention to be an engineer. It was always my intention to be an architect. So I went along with it. And it opened some doors for me, which I will never regret. Firstly, working with Becker Carter Hollings and Ferner, as they were then known in New Zealand. They were the largest engineering consultancy in the country and fairly big in a world sense as well. And they were the world's leading experts on seismic design at the time, and maybe still are, who knows, now known as Becker. And what they did was recognized from an early stage that I was really an architect in waiting, and I wasn't ever going to be a structural engineer. And I was studying as a structural engineering technician, not a full engineering degree. So that allowed me to work in an office and study part-time, which was the only way I could survive. It was a great experience. And the directors at Becker's, many of whom had worked at Overeem Partners in London in their earlier careers. So one day they came to me, and I'd been working on a very big bridging project in Papua New Guinea. And they called me in after lunch, one of the directors, and he said, "We're sending you to New Guinea to be assistant project architect on this bridging project." And I said, "Oh, that's terrible news, because I've just gone out at lunchtime and booked a ticket to go and live in London." So I had to turn down the offer to go to New Guinea, which I thought I was going to regret forever. But as an interesting twist of fate, my first building was actually in Port Moresby many years later. So I did get to go to New Guinea eventually. So that was all good. But when I went to London, they very kindly arranged a job for me at Arup's within the Industrial and Offshore Engineering Group, who basically built or designed off-sea oil platforms in the North Sea, telecommunications towers, big industrial facilities. So it was an interesting world that I hadn't really been involved with before. And luckily, Norman Foster had just won the competition for the Hong Kong Shanghai Bank building in Hong Kong in 1979. And I arrived in London the beginning of 1980, and he had used the analogy of a North Sea oil platform as the main structural frame of the bank. So he came to the building and engineering group within Arup's to design the structure. So I was in the right place at the right time.
Yeah, right, because Sir Norman Foster has gone on to design Apple headquarters and some of the world's most iconic buildings, but this is not when he's a rock star architect, right?
This is the project that basically turned him into a star architect. It was at the time the most expensive building ever built. Its build cost was $6 billion, which doesn't sound all that much now, but back then it certainly was. It was one of the most important buildings of the 20th century, or the late 20th century anyway.
And you designed you made it stand up.
And yeah, I worked on the structure and I worked on the main frame. I spent most of my time on the main structural frame, but spent a lot of time on the service pods, which are hung from that frame, as well as a little bit of work on the link bridges that link the lift cores into the main floors. So it's a very interesting building. And what I learned from that was that I was in the wrong place. I was going to Foster's office two or three times a week for quite lengthy meetings. And I'm looking around and seeing all these guys wearing jeans and t-shirts and, you know, sneakers. And I'm there in a three-piece suit and tie. And I'm thinking, wow, I want to be one of these guys. And I'm looking at their drawings, incredible drawing, everything hand-drawn back in those early days, except for the grids and the main columns, which they were using a massive computer at Arup's to draw, but that was all they could draw. Everything else had to be added to those drawings by hand. Getting that experience through my father not wanting me to be an architect was incredible. So during that period, working on the bank, I spent time in Hong Kong, part of the team, not living, but going there on a regular basis to have a look at things on site. And then I switched to architecture. I went through a very rigorous interview process at the South Bank Polytechnic, as it was then, in London, and got accepted into the architecture school, only to be told the next day my work permit had expired and I was no longer welcome in the UK and had to leave and go back to New Zealand or possibly Australia. So I had to run upstairs to the architecture library at Arup Associates, the architectural division of Arup & Partners, and go through all of their copies of Architecture Australia, which they had in the library, and try and work out who I could work for back in Australia and what the architect schools were like, and was there a part-time one that I could enter. And so NISWIT was the one, New South Wales Institute of Technology, as it was then, later UTS. So then I quickly wrote to the then head of school and got a position. So I flew back to Sydney and started my architecture studies.
Yeah, right.
While still working on the Hong Kong Bank for another year within Arup's office in North Sydney.
That's incredible, because that's not a time when you'd think that you could sort of, there's no Zoom, there's no working from remote places. You would have faxed things, right?
We did. But you know what we had, which I've never seen anywhere else? Because we were working with a lot of Japanese subcontractors on the building, they had A3 faxes.
A3 faxes. Of course they did.
Yeah. And that was the other thing I learned from Foster's, which translated into my own architectural practices. You draw everything on A3. You try never to draw on big sheets of paper that we were always used to drawing on. So from that moment on, I've only ever produced A3 drawings. And we would fax them through to Japan and wherever else. It was great because you were sending sketches and things and just faxing them through. We thought that was incredible.
Obviously, you established practice in Sydney eventually. Who did you work for? Where was your grounding in architecture, or where was the apprenticeship?
Well, it was interesting because I worked for Arup's for that year. And after 1 year of your architecture degree course at NISWIT, you had to then move into an architectural office. For the first year, you could work anywhere, but second year had to be in an architectural practice. So I joined Don Gazzard and Partners. And Don Gazzard, as you may know, was a very, very highly regarded architect back in the 70s and 80s in Sydney. And I worked for him for probably about 6 months on a couple of projects. But I didn't totally love what I was working on. And then one of the guys in my class at university was the chief model maker for Philip Cox and Partners, as Cox Architects were then known. And he had a big model shop in Oxford Street in Darlinghurst. And so he asked a number of us from our class, who he obviously had been keeping an eye on us, seeing who made good models. And he asked us if we could join their model shop on contract to do a major project in Canberra. So I left Don Gazzard, went to Cox's Model Shop for 3 or 4 months. And then I got an offer of a job from another person in my class who was married to Daryl Conybeare of Conybeare Morrison. So they offered me a position and I stayed there probably for a couple of years. And I worked on some very interesting projects there, but they were more sort of master planner type architects. And I actually wanted to be building things. Also felt a need to learn more about the interior side of things, which at architecture school was sort of brushed over a bit. But I wanted to be a traditional architect who did everything, exterior, interior, right down to the furniture, artwork, bed linen, knives and forks, whatever, you know, anything they'd let me touch, I would do. So the practice at the time that was very interesting for me, and I saw their work published all the time, was Neil Burley and Partners, who are an interior design office. So I got a position with them, which was great. And I was the only architect there at the time. All the others were interior designers. And when I graduated in 1988, they asked me to become a director of the architectural division, which they were setting up.
So Balmoral House, what I really, really want to talk to you about. We've kind of got your, which is a brilliant and varied skill set. So you've had this great experience. And my first experience of true architectural design, I mean, I built a few houses, I did a few things, worked with architects, but nothing like Balmoral House. That was a very different thing, built in a very different way. It was totally my first experience. And I had to think, I had to get inside your mind and the design team to understand what you needed to get out of it for me to enable me to build it. Rather than just follow instructions, I had to think about what it is you wanted to communicate. And that was a very different thing. That was a very, like, complete departure. Can you tell us about where the project started?
An interesting one, because we had a few issues there, primarily to do with fitting the house that our client wanted on a site that was, to be honest, a touch too small for what he wanted. And the biggest issue there was that we had a very steeply sloping site, and the height limit that we were working to in Mossman Council's controls was a rolling height limit that follows the natural ground level. And if you try to build a house on a site like that, there's only really one way to do it, and that's to step it. And the stepping of it in not only one direction, but in this case, two directions, because it was falling down the slope of the street, as well as falling from front to back of the site, with the main view, which was extraordinary, out diagonally through to the northeast towards Manly across Middle Harbour and out to the Heads. So when we started doing our little overlays with the height limits and trying to step a building that would fit within that envelope, it was the transitions between the various levels and how you could effectively get two parts of the building to be connected to each other, but at the same time almost being totally dislocated as two separate pavilions on the site. And that was the way that we chose to do it, to get sort of overcome the stepping issue, because otherwise we would have had sloping roof in one direction and sloping roof in the other direction. So it's better to break the building into two. And the other thing that was really working in our favor was that the site fanned out towards the rear, and it fanned out towards the big view. So there was this beautiful position where you could actually enter from the street across a bridge and pass between the two pavilions and look straight out into this incredible view. So the concept was to treat the space between the two pavilions as an outdoor space. So it was clad with the same stone tiles as the exterior, and it wasn't until you went through entry portals in the side of each of the two pavilions that you could say you're officially inside the building.
Yeah, and it finished with a pool at the end. So you've stepped, my memory of it is walking across the bridge, there was a frameless glass sliding door that was automated, timber stairs that were like a deck, and then at the bottom was a pool. And it was just like, I've never seen anything like it.
Thank you. And that was all about navigating the controls in a way that was not foreseen by a council planner in writing their controls. And that's where architects bring unique training and can take what are really constraints but make them into opportunities. And the other thing that, because initially we had designed it as a copper-clad building. You know, we were playing around with whether it's bronze or copper, but, you know, we were going to use copper cladding. And the council refused to allow us to do that and said, no, you know, you have to have a stone building or a masonry building, so brick primarily is what they were thinking. And I thought, well, it's very difficult, but not impossible, but very difficult to build a masonry building on such a steeply sloping site without costing a great deal of money. And it would have been hard, and particularly to get some of the more delicate aspects of the house to work with a heavy structure. I'm playing a game with you here. I'm giving you a stone building, but I'm going to be very cheeky and actually not let the building touch the ground. So there's a massive stone building, but it's hanging in midair. So you'll remember that cantilever at the front. So there was about a meter or so of the building that literally was floating about a meter off the ground. And that was my own little jab back at the council and planners. But it was very nice the way it just allowed the building to just float there. The frameless glass door, which when you looked at it from the street, you sort of think, well, is there a door there? Or did you just walk in the bridge and just go between these two pavilions? That was how it came about. And then there were a couple of other sort of split levels within the pavilions themselves to navigate not only the council height controls, but also there was a height covenant established when the site was subdivided off from the next door neighbor. So we had to fit everything underneath that height covenant as well. So very difficult, but I was very happy with the outcome of the design.
Just to describe it, I mean, the stone was a dark gray basalt and quite striking, and particularly when it had a beautiful angophora in front of it. And I remember being photographed, but essentially it was a lightweight building clad in stone, and every space felt good. I remember just going, yeah, the proportions, like something about this really works well. The spaces work. And it had really like an ordered program of material where it had stone and then the stone finished, and you had the windows, and the windows were the column and the beams between the stone were clad in a material that was an aluminium, that was an anodized bronze aluminium. And that gave me lots of headaches as a junior builder to find a way to clad and on a budget as well. So I don't know if you remember or you even saw, but I essentially broke it down into panels and angles. So where you intended to fold things, I was like, well, folding, drawing and folding is quite a lot more difficult than angles and flat. So I made it all kind of work for the budget, essentially.
Yeah. I mean, the budget was an issue because our client was, well, he basically engaged a building company, wasn't one of our normal builders doing it. And so he felt he had control over the situation and could make decisions about cost and design without referring back to his architect sometimes. So we were sort of trying to design what he wanted, but he was sort of chipping away at it in the background. And so there were a few shortcuts taken, which, you know, often there are. But I think despite that, the integrity of the design was well and truly maintained, and we got a great outcome. And I'm not sure that you're aware, you may well be, that we were recently approached by the new owner who bought it a year or so ago, and lovely client. She said she loved the house. She said it was timeless. She walked into it and it felt as if it had just been built, and yet it was 20 years old. And she said there were just some little things that she wanted to update. And the major thing was the color of the timber joinery, which was originally all American white oak. And it's still, apart from maybe one panel that looked as though it had been scratched by a dog, was in almost perfect condition, but she didn't like the color. And she wanted it to be dark chocolate brown, she said, is what she wanted. So we've gone through a process of removing all the doors and drawer fronts throughout the entire house and making them a smoked oak. It actually worked out beautifully because it sits very comfortably with the basalt in terms of its color.
So back a step to the comment about it being, and her comment about it being timeless, because particularly when my kids were younger, we would go to Balmoral Beach. I'm one of those people that would rather walk a kilometre than try and wrestle for a parking spot. So I knew the street was above Balmoral, and it's a pretty reliable street to get a park on. So I was like, this is where we park. And yeah, it's a bit of a walk, but it's certainly better than driving around, particularly on a nice day when everyone's there and we want to be there too, right? But my son saw that, so I showed the kids the house, and my son, who must have been, so this is a while ago, he's now 17, this is probably 10 years ago, that I showed him, and I said, I helped build that house. I was the project manager, and it blew him away. As a young kid, he just said, that looks like it was just built today or yesterday. And then he said, Dad, you built a future house. And I was like, oh, okay. And I was like, yeah, it is. It really stood up well. And I guess where this podcast came about, or where this episode came about, is kind of trying to explore, like, what is it that makes design timeless? Because that's certainly, of all the buildings that I've been involved in, it's an example of timeless design. And I have a few ideas, but what is it? What is it that makes it timeless?
Well, I go back to some of my own personal experiences. Firstly, I won the Biera Hadley Travelling Scholarship just after I left university back in 1990, when I literally just started my own practice at the same time. And that was a travelling scholarship, and I had won it on the basis of my study topic, which was to look at contemporary infill building in historic European cities. And one of the main people that I wanted to go and really study was José Antonio Cadurc in Barcelona. And I'd become aware of his work when I was a student through a book that I found. And immediately I saw his work. I thought, this is some of the best architecture I've seen. And he did buildings which, to this day, I consider to be timeless. His apartment buildings, particularly his Barceloneta apartment building on the edge of the harbour in Barcelona, built in the 1950s, but it could have been built yesterday as well. And his Ugalde house, which is in Girona on the coast, again, it's one of those houses, you can't put a date on it. You know that it's not absolutely contemporary, but you don't know whether it was built in the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, could have been any of them. But the thing that to me makes it timeless is firstly the quality of the spaces and the way the spaces relate to the site and the climate. So they're not traditional buildings that have very small cellular rooms, the way that, you know, typical 19th century and earlier buildings were built. They were more open and the plans were more flexible, but the materials that these buildings were built with were usually materials that almost no maintenance materials. These are stone or they're masonry, terracotta. In some way, they're just materials that age really, really well. And that ability for materials not to age, I think, is a key component of being timeless, because you don't get that wear and tear or the lack of maintenance, which highlights the fact that it's been sitting there for years with no one looking after it. And then the other buildings that I consider to be timeless still to this day are in Milan, some of my favorite apartment buildings. And when I first went to Milan back in 1980, I saw some of these buildings, and this was before I'd studied architecture, and I'm going, these buildings are amazing, and I didn't know when they'd been built. And some of them were built in the 1930s, and others were built in the 1950s, and some in the 60s and 70s. But you couldn't really tell which was which. Quite easily, the ones that were built in the 70s, you would have said, well, maybe they were built in the 30s. But again, materials such as terrazzo and stone, you know, that the Romans had used thousands of years ago were used in those buildings, and materials like brass and bronze, so that, you know, door handles and fixtures and fittings, they're made from materials that just don't age. Or if they do age, they age really gracefully. So that combination of the more interesting architectural planning with those long life, low maintenance materials, I think is really important aspect to it. And then the one other thing that is essential to be timeless is to be completely outside of any trend. If you start thinking, okay, oh, everyone's designing buildings that look like this, or they're made out of this, or they're this color, you're going to date them straight away. And so throughout my entire career, not necessarily consciously, but obviously it's embedded in my psyche that I don't want to be someone who's copying the latest thing. I want to do my own thing, and I want my thing to be timeless, because I've seen these buildings that are timeless, and every building I design, I try just to make it a building that's going to last 100, 150 years, hopefully, and without any clues to when it was built. And I have a funny little story about this. I designed a warehouse for my wife and I in Surry Hills back in 2008. It was finished in 2010. And we lived in that for 11 years. And when we came to sell it, there was a minor problem with the garage door. So we called in the garage door guy to come and fix the problem. Came out and he looked at it, walked around the garage, looked into the house, checked the garage door, and he said, "I know what the problem is." He said, "They've given you 10-year-old equipment." And I'm going, "The house was built 11 years ago." And he said, "What?" He thought it was brand new. He thought we were just finishing the build of the house, and yet we were actually just about to sell it after 11 years. But he was convinced it was new. And I thought, well, that's a pretty good story. He was blaming old equipment, but wasn't at all.
Ian, there must be more to it, because it wasn't the only house to have that stone. It wasn't so unusual to have stone, and there was plenty of basalt laid. That was not an uncommon material in that particular time period, the early mid 2000s. It's got to be something about the way it was set out, or the way it...
It's the language of it. It's the architectural language. It's not saying, "I'm a house." It doesn't have those traditional things that identify it as a house. It's these two separate elements which don't have a roof as such. So you don't identify it as a house in the traditional sense because it doesn't have a roof. It's a building, you know, it's a building, but quite sure what it is because it doesn't have any of the typical residential clues that you would expect in a suburban house. The material, while basalt relatively common, I don't believe that there are a lot of places that use the cladding in the way that I did there, which was to, again, play up that little game I was playing with council. Rather than laying the stone horizontally and using a traditional brick bond, it was vertical and it was in a stack bond, which says, again, to someone in the know, this is non-structural. This is a cladding. This is not a masonry building. This is just putting stone on it to satisfy council to get an approval. So it's a little bit of gameplay. And then the bronze was really my take on those buildings in Milan, where bronze was a material that was used so often because it was seen to be timeless and has proven to be timeless. And we used to use real bronze, but real bronze was vastly expensive and very difficult to get hold of. So a bronze aluminium was something that we could use to get a similar look and feel to it. And also because it's right above the beach, so it's in a marine environment. So the aluminium was, again, a really great choice, and that's that maintenance issue. You're not having to paint the building every 5 years to maintain it. It's a material that's going to last for a very long time.
And I can testify to the fact that every other building that was built from, I don't know what year, 2005 to 20, a long time after that, was a clear anodized. Everything was clear anodized. So yeah, that was really different. It was a real outlier, but it looked spectacular. I think there's also an intention to paint the internals a dark color, but I think the owner sort of drew the line at, no, I really want it to be white. I remember that there was a suggestion to create some sort of a darker, moodier interior as well.
Yeah, I think that we achieved that with the floor, though. You know, the honed basalt, which is, you know, most people tend to think of lighter floors, whether it's a timber floor or a carpet floor, but to use stone and then use a very dark stone internally was unusual because that's seen more as an external paving material. But we didn't go white. Now, my usual paint is Dulux Vivid White, and I've always used Dulux Vivid White and love it. But in that case, because we had the basalt internally and we had the American white oak, we actually went to a slightly different color called White Duck. It's not too creamy, but it's not really sharp white. And it was a very nice transition between the stone and the timber. In the work that we've just done there to just update the house a bit, we've used the same white that we did originally to repaint everything.
And so talk to me about trends, because trends are something that architects deny, but obviously there's influences. So what's the difference between a trend and an influence? Because obviously your building and your buildings are influenced by modernist architecture from else. Like, there's a definitive lineage. What's the difference? Where does an influence become a trend?
Well, I think a trend is something that's picked up by people who necessarily in the profession. It's things that the general public might relate to because the media plays up on them, or particularly now with Instagram and TikTok and everything else, easy to get something out to a lot of people. Whereas previously it was really publication, which was the big thing. And I think that the houses that I've always related to were the case study houses in California from the 1940s, 50s. And what they were about was not a trend in terms of the architecture initially. What it was about was lifestyle, that there was a climate in LA which is so similar to Sydney's and also to Barcelona and a couple of other places in the world. There's some great architecture of a similar kind, where you had this relationship between inside and out, where you want the house to open up because the weather was so good, you know, you could be outside for a good part of the year. And also the use of glass so that you, again, break down those barriers between inside and out. You take advantage of the views from the inside. Those houses were built when there was an enormous shortage of building materials. And so it's about using the least possible material to build these houses, and they're lightweight, which in California, obviously a seismic area, the lightweight was part of that. But those houses always resonated with me, and they were development of things that Mies van der Rohe had done previously, you know, Barcelona Pavilion and his Farnsworth House and other buildings. So people like Craig Elwood and Pierre Koenig were the people that I was influenced by. So I took those general approaches to designing residential buildings, which climate related and also, you know, in environmental issues like natural cross ventilation, natural daylight, rather than, you know, sealed boxes that are air conditioned. So that's where that came from. But I studied at a time when there was this major change between the orthodoxy of the sort of modern movement and the introduction of postmodernism. And so at my university, everyone was drawing postmodern buildings. You know, they were quite strongly colored. They had traditional forms, which were highly abstracted, but they were a bit like Lego houses, a bit like sort of some sort of cartoon town. And it was the big thing. I did one project, which was a study of Aldo Rossi, the great Italian rationalist architect, and looking at how he worked. So I worked through an entire project doing my one and only supposed postmodern scheme just to get it out of my system. But then I went back to my roots. But I think that, so if people that have always designed on those very simple, straightforward, logical, modern principles, they just keep doing it because to me it's the right way to do things. And so there's no need to change something if it works, and you can play around within that language to produce an enormous variety of buildings without having to resort to the sort of pastiche of traditional forms. And then The things that I suppose are trends now are a lot to do with materials and finishes. And a lot of that's to do with the amount of publication and also with social media and real estate agents and developers picking up on what architects and interior designers are doing and then using that over and over and over again to the point where everything ends up looking exactly the same. Whereas the good architects in town just keep doing their own thing.
So you pointed to, I guess, postmodernism as to some people that was a trend for architects, right? So I guess that's the conundrum that and when you talk to architects, they're like, no, there's no trend. It's an art, right? And I'm like, well, you see what the architects are all, they sort of, something becomes topical and trendy in architecture. I guess it's more considered, but you can certainly see architects following each other, right? You can certainly see that in the last few years, pastels and other things have become quite fashionable and a lot of the pointy end architects do that and they kind of look the same. So there must be a correlation. And yeah, sure, I take your point about trends. Yeah, they're in and out but isn't that the same thing? Don't architects have trends on a longer time scale, bigger? They're not flipped. It's not house and garden where something's trendy this year and out the next winter.
It's definitely that. And I think that the bigger picture, though, is the environmental side of things, where there's been an increased awakening of the need to do something urgently about our climate crisis. And a lot of people have said, well, wood's the answer, so let's build things in timber, you know, so you get a lot of timber buildings suddenly being built. And there's other people that would argue that, well, if you use a material like steel or aluminium, yes, it's got more embodied energy, it costs more initially, but it's a material that will last just about forever. Particularly when you talk about aluminium, where 75% of all aluminium ever made in the history of the world is still in the production, still in the system and can be recycled and put back into production. So aluminium, despite its very high initial cost to produce, is one of the cheapest and easiest materials to recycle. So there's lots of arguments about which is the correct way to go at the moment, but you've definitely seen a certain approach to architecture that has changed dramatically in the last 5 or 10 years because of the environmental crisis. But again, I would say that all good architects that have been working for a long time have been doing this from day one. And it's nothing new. It's just that the world is slowly, too slowly, but luckily speeding up in their understanding that we have a problem and we have to deal with it. And the people who are best qualified to deal with it are the architects. So there is a lot of commonality in the thinking at the moment between architects and how you resolve some of these issues and how you build buildings which are environmentally responsive, but also doing all the right things in terms of the people that live in them and their lifestyle and the climate. So the combination of that is producing buildings of a particular type at the moment, which I think people are starting to understand, but you need to sort of scratch a bit deeper to understand the real background to it. And I think that's the environmental awareness. But also the fact that we're trying to build a lot more houses now to take care of this housing crisis. But the most environmentally sustainable building is the building that already exists. So, you know, demolishing existing buildings is not the way to do it. A lot of local councils think that's the answer, you know, knock down really good houses and build two where there used to be one and suddenly you've dealt with the problem. But that's not, because you're creating more of a problem by demolishing all these things and having wasted energy and materials and energy. So it's still a conundrum, it hasn't been solved. Everyone's working their way towards something, but we're not quite there yet. But it's a good point in time for architects to take back control of a lot of these issues, because we're really the only ones that have been educated in all aspects of architecture and building and sustainable side of things to actually put everything together that works the way it should. And we're starting to get now government listening and doing some of the right things, not all the right things, but sort of moving in the right direction.
And speaking of moving in the right or wrong direction, I mean, you mentioned back in the 80s the A3 fax machine, which was a revelation and a huge innovation. The uncertainty is great, but certainly in terms of technology, it feels like it's moving quicker. And by virtue of trillions of dollars invested in things like AI. And I said to one of our architects, it feels like we're adapting to email and moving from 2D drawings drawn by hand to free. And we're doing like the equivalent of all of those things all at once. Where do you see the role of the architect changing with technology evolving?
Well, I think that we all adapted pretty quickly when we went from drawing by hand to drawing on a computer, even though I admit that I don't draw on a computer. And I still have my little drawing board that I work on. But I think that the profession adapted very quickly to that. It will adapt very quickly to AI. And what you're seeing now is primarily it's a visual thing with AI. It's about making renders of buildings look so realistic, even more so than what we've had for the last 10, 15 years, to the point where it's often hard to distinguish between a render and a finished building. And I think that that is all great. But what we're seeing is particularly the development in the real estate industry, selling something by way of renders, which are only going to get better, which is never, ever going to be delivered. So I think the thing that really matters most is that architects are the ones that are able to actually build buildings which are as close as possible to the original design, whereas people who are just generating, you know, beautiful images don't know how to actually turn that into reality, whereas architects do. And with that, with the help of our incredibly important teams of builders and subcontractors, it's still a traditional process of putting bits of material together to make a building. And I think the danger is that people can make incredibly good images that you can't distinguish from a real photograph, but don't know how to actually build what they're drawing. So that's the art that may get lost if we don't really put a lot more effort into educating younger architects into how you actually build a building, how you put it together. And I mean, I take that part of my role in the profession very seriously about training younger architects to actually understand how to design and document buildings that can be built to finish up looking as close as physically possible to what we've actually set out to design in our initial concept. I think that's the key thing at the moment, is understanding that it's still a very labor-intensive manual process to build buildings. And until we get total automation of the building industry, which may or may not ever come, you rely on people, you rely on humans that make mistakes sometimes, but they can fix them, you know, and you go through this process of putting one piece of material on top of another and joining it somehow. And eventually, like a Lego building, you just put the blocks together and you end up with the end result. And I think that's what people really don't quite understand is what's involved in building a building and how complex it is, and that AI may be able to at some point in time have enough knowledge built into it from ourselves that it could document a building. I don't know. At this stage, it's too early to say that that's possible. But
yeah. Oh, look, I think it's almost inevitable. I mean, you see what it's doing and you extrapolate. It's almost inevitable that it design from, I guess I've been looking at it and from an efficiency perspective, looking at how we can streamline our process, not so much focused on design, but what I can see the technology doing is there's almost certainly a crossover where an architect will be more like a curator, where you can generate lots of ideas very, very quickly. I mean, I don't think that's a disaster. You still need someone to work out which idea that's generated is not a hallucination and is the best for that client given the personal knowledge of the brief and the objectives.
I mean, I think a lot of people use it now in its current state to produce lots of different iterations of a concept. So, you know, rather than laboring over, you know, 15 different options, you know, they can produce 15 different options in a very short period of time, but you still have to select the right one. And that's the critical thing, because all of them might have their positive and negatives, and it's the architect's eye that can actually say, well, that's the one that answers all of the problems that we've got to solve, or looks the most beautiful, whatever the criteria that you're applying to it, that is the thing that we still have control over.
We'll wrap up shortly, but I'll just ask you one more question. Like, what are you working on right now that you would consider to be timeless?
Well, we've just literally, in the last few days, finished an exceptionally important project, which is known as the Corner Store, which is an adaptive reuse project in Surry Hills. The building was built in 1869 as a public house known as the Mortlark Hotel. In the 1920s, it became a fruit and vegetable shop, and in the 1960s, it became a corner grocery shop, and we have just converted it to a house. And the most important aspect of it was marrying the existing original 1869 facade of the building with a contemporary, really like an insert into that of this new house. And the building was in such a poor state of repair, the facade was falling out into the street by up to 300 millimeters. We had to create a new steel framework within it to hold it all up, and we had to thread that through before we did any demolition work. And then we've made a very clear distinction between what's the original building and what's the new building, and the whole of the rear of the building is clad in glass block. So this is the new bit and the other bit is the old bit. So we've maintained the really important things like streetscape in, you know, a row of terrace houses in Burke Street. This was the bookend, this was the pub, but, you know, the corner stores and pubs were always the bookends to rows of terraces, so we've maintained that. We've changed its use from being a pub to being a house, but kept all the sort of architectural qualities of the original to enhance the street, but then added our own new bit to say this is, you know, something that's been added quite recently, but it works as a whole still, even though they're two very different halves that have been spliced together. So that's a very important project for me, and I've been working on it for 7 years. Two different clients, a refusal from council initially because they simply couldn't understand what we were doing because it just didn't fit in the normal box that they could tick. So they just thought it's better to say no. So we, you know, went through the Land Environment Court process and then a minor modification to a DA. And then COVID came, and then our original clients decided at the end of COVID that it wasn't something that they wanted to proceed with, and they sold the site. And the new client, thankfully, only made very minor adjustments to the design, and we were able to get it built. And it literally finished a week or so ago. So, yeah, that's probably the most important recent one. And then, you know, these days I primarily work on single residential projects. Back when you first knew me, you know, I was doing a lot of apartment developments, and apartment developments have moved a long way since those days. And they're much more difficult to do, typically with the speed that developers require you to work. You need quite a big team. And that's why a lot of the big architecture practices are now doing multi-residential work, which they weren't doing back then. They were doing commercial. So, you know, the architectural world has changed a bit in that respect as well. But I'm very happy doing the sort of single residential things because I have control over every aspect of the project. And that's what I like. You know, I am a control freak and I do want to be involved in all the stages. And that's what you get when you ask me to do a project, you get me. You know, I have my great team working with me, but you get me at every stage of the process. I'm not just getting the job in the door and then handing it over to some other people within my team to design it, document it, and administer the contract. It's me, right through to the very end. And that's what I love. You know, that's what I've loved since I was a kid on my father's building sites. I loved when I was doing my engineering, and I've loved ever since I started architecture.
And I look forward to seeing the Corner Store house. I'd love to check it out one day.
You'll see it very soon.
Yeah. All right. Ian Moore, thanks so much for joining us. It's been a thrill to have you on Buildopedia, and thank you so much.
Been my pleasure. Thank you again for the invitation. Great to talk to you.
Thanks, Ian.
Thanks.
You've been listening to Buildapedia. Please remember to like us and share our episode with your friends. We'd love your comments and suggestions. And we have a new website, buildapedia.au, where you can get in touch or leave a question and check out our blog.